Good morning to you all. Good to be with you on another Lord's Day. Matthew 9, the text that was just read for us into chapter 10 is the place where we will camp this morning, so I encourage you to pay close attention to the words of Matthew in that spot. If you are tracking with the sheet that I passed out at the beginning of the year, that kind of mapped out all of the lessons that we're going to be looking at this year, then you know that we're in the Matthew 8 through 10 phase, which on that sheet I labeled how the kingdom affects lives. And I want to just ask us to think about, not just today, but as we're going through all of these lessons, whether the kingdom of Jesus is affecting our lives in real and practical ways. Because in these stories that we're reading about here in Matthew 8 through 10, Jesus is having a sweeping and dramatic effect on the lives of all of these different people that he is teaching and healing, performing miracles on. And while we're not going to have the opportunity to do something like we see the woman with the hemorrhage doing of coming up to Jesus' person and touching his clothes, and immediately we're made well, Jesus still to this day is having sweeping and dramatic effects on the lives of people who read these stories and listen to what he says and follow them. And so I want to encourage us to think about whether we are applying what we know Scripture says to ourselves. If we're not doing a lot of personal application, that could come from a couple of different sources. It could mean that there's something inside of our hearts right now that is preventing us from doing a lot of application. So it could just be laziness, for example. It could just be, I've heard this before, and I don't really want to try much harder than I'm trying right now. Or if we're not applying, it could be because we're just not very practiced in doing that. Maybe we've just never taken the time to learn how to think through a word and a passage and how that addresses specific parts of our lives. And so whether it is that you need just simple motivation or whether you need knowledge of how to apply, regardless of which one it is for you, I think that one of the most powerful ways that we can start or restart that process in our hearts is to pay very close attention to what Jesus does. These stories that we have of him, that's why we have so many, both within this one gospel and as well as the other ones, the other gospels that we have. Because it's one thing to read Leviticus where it says in chapter 19, love your neighbor as yourself. It's one thing to read that, and then it's another thing to actually see this in action on the ground level as Jesus does this. And you remember, Jesus rubbed elbows with a lot of people who did not understand what Leviticus 19 actually was saying. Well, does it mean that I gotta love the people that I like, the people that look like me, the people who speak my language, the people who are fellow Jews? No, it means a lot more than that. And Jesus helped them with that. So the more we see these stories, the more we digest them, the more we are going to be caused to do application in more powerful ways. And quite frankly, that's one of the main reasons why I'm preaching through the entire book of Matthew this year. It's so that we can grow in personal application, both for myself and for you. So this lesson today is about seeing stories that highlight the compassion of Jesus. What Jesus does with compassion is he sees needs, and he doesn't just meet them personally, he mobilizes the other people around him to come alongside of him as he meets those needs. And so if we have compassion, we're going to do the same thing. Okay, so let's talk about these blind guys in the first part of the reading in chapter 9, 27 through 31. And I want to notice what they do as they come to Jesus, because what Jesus does to them, for them, doesn't at first seem very compassionate, but he is allowing them to display their faith in what they do. So the text says that, and I believe that this is a different story from Bartimaeus, by the way, if you're familiar with that blind guy. He comes later on in the Gospel of Matthew. Here we have two blind guys, and different things are happening, so I think it's a different story. But I want you to notice in the text that these blind guys are following behind Jesus through the town and into the house where Jesus goes. I want you to think about that for just a second. I have never been blind, and I don't think most of us in this room have ever experienced that before. But do you suppose that if you have that disability, that this would have been a very difficult thing for these two guys to do? Now, there's a lot of maybes that we don't know about in this scenario. Like, maybe there was a huge crowd following Jesus, and so maybe all they had to do was kind of follow the noise of the people clomping through the streets. And maybe they're from this town. Maybe they know these streets super well, and so that maybe it's not that hard for them to get around. Maybe they have friends that can come alongside of them and lead them through this town. There's a lot of things we don't know, but I'm sure that what is true is this took some degree of effort for the blind to follow the scene. And notice what happens as they follow. They're trying to get him to stop. They're trying to get his attention. They're yelling out. They're shouting. And he doesn't stop. He keeps on going until he gets to the house. Have mercy on us. You know, if you were in their shoes, would you think, well, maybe he's just not hearing us, so let's yell a little louder. And he doesn't stop. And so maybe you go on and you go a couple of more streets down, and then maybe you're thinking, ooh, maybe he does hear us. And he's just not that interested in trying to talk to us and figure out what is going on with our lives. He doesn't want to bother. Maybe he's so busy with other people that our problems are way down his priority list. And even when they do finally chase him down and they go into the house, did you notice that even then, when they finally get to talk to him, he still doesn't heal them immediately? He asks them, so do you guys believe? And I think that a smart aleck in that situation would have said, dude, if we didn't believe, do you think that we would bump through all of these streets blind in order to get to your house, in order to talk to you and make this request? Now, what Jesus is doing here is he's recognizing what you did was faith. What you did in acting out this belief was faith. But you need to verbalize this. You need to make the request. You need to acknowledge my power verbally. I think this point is just so applicable to us, that belief is shown by persistence in following after Jesus, despite a lack of immediate results. I think in all kinds of ways, you and I are going to have times in our lives where we feel like we're bumping along the street, chasing after Jesus, and it seems like he's ignoring us, it seems like he's not stopping, it seems like he's constantly out of reach, but what he's doing is he's giving you and me an opportunity to do this, to demonstrate faith, because he's waiting at the house for you to come in so that he can heal you. And so if you are a discouraged Christian, in your role, in your family, in your church, whatever role, whatever hat you wear, whatever gender you are, whatever thing you do, if you are a discouraged parent, if you are a discouraged grandparent, if you are a discouraged shepherd, you are a discouraged sheep. If you are a discouraged anybody, in whatever role you are in, do not stop praying. Do not stop working. Do not stop talking to and being alongside the people that God has put in your path. Even if you feel blind now, there is healing at the house. So keep going. As an Old Testament side note, I think this is really, really cool. Hold your finger in Matthew and flip back really quick to the book of Isaiah. I want to read a couple of passages from this text, because what I think you see going on here is a demonstration of what Isaiah is saying in the life of Jesus. So Isaiah chapter 29, I'm gonna look here starting in verse 17. Isaiah 29, 17. Is it not yet a very little while until Lebanon shall be turned into a fruitful field, and the fruitful field shall be regarded as a forest? In that day the deaf shall hear the words of a book, and out of their gloom and darkness, here it is, the eyes of the blind shall see. The meek shall obtain fresh joy in the Lord, and the poor among mankind shall exult in the Holy One of Israel. And he goes on to talk about how God's going to make an end of the people who are not meek. They're not going to have fresh joy, but lowly blind people will. And you go on to chapter 35, and we got a similar passage here. Chapter 35, let's start reading here in verse 1. The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong. Fear not, behold, your God will come with vengeance, with the recompense of God. He will come and save you. Then, here it is, the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute, which is, by the way, the next story after this one in Matthew, the tongue of the mute shall sing for joy. For waters break forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The burning sand shall become a pool, and the thirsty ground springs of water. In the haunt of jackals where they lie down, the grass shall become reeds and rushes, and a highway shall be there, and shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it. It shall belong to those who walk in the way. Even if they are fools, they shall not go astray. It's like when you play Mario Kart and there are the bumpers. There are the settings that you turn on so that you can't fly off into the abyss. That's the way of holiness. It's the way of our God. You can't fall off if He's got you and you're safe. And so this healing that Jesus is doing here, and in all of these stories clustered around this particular story, is a demonstration of the sight that He is giving souls, not just the healing that He's giving bodies. Okay, so let's go back to Matthew 9. I want to notice what happens toward the end of this little story that we've got about them, because I think we need to absorb this point that people who are excited, rightly so, about the healing that Jesus is giving to them, that they still need to be careful to make sure that they follow whatever the king has said as they enjoy what he's given. For me, I was definitely really excited after I had LASIK surgery and I didn't have to put in contacts anymore or wear glasses anymore. But how much more excited do you think these guys were to go from no vision at all to now they can see like eagles. Because when Jesus heals a body, you know, he's gonna max it out. So I imagine that when this happens, and they figure out what has actually occurred, and they're looking around the room, and they're looking at Jesus, and they're seeing things that perhaps they've never seen before or have not seen in years and years. I'm sure that they're chattering with each other about all the people that they're going to go tell, because I'm sure they've got friends, they've got relatives who are going to be excited with them, but then they're cut short by the one who has healed them. And in verse 30, I think most translations in this room are probably going to say something like, he sternly warned them. That's a pretty good translation of that word in the original, because this isn't a tone of, hey guys, I know you're really excited, but you know, it would probably be good if you didn't say anything about this. No, the tone is, don't tell anybody. Don't do it. Really? Can you imagine being one of these guys and being told that? That's the most wet blanket thing that these guys have probably ever heard anybody say to them, coming right after the most exciting moment of their lives. What do you mean we can't tell anybody? Sure that there's a lot of people who would want to know about this. Jesus, don't you want people to understand that you have this kind of power? Don't you want us to evangelize? Don't you want us to spread the word? No, I don't. Not around here. See to it that no one knows about it. Why not? Well, isn't it interesting that Matthew does not get into the why here, because ultimately the why doesn't really matter. But if you go to Mark's account, I will just mention this, that when Mark mentions that he told people things like this and they did not obey him, that made his life harder in his ministry work. So he would want to go into a town, but as a result of disobedience in this kind of way, he had to remain in desolate places, Mark 1 says, and then have people come out to him. So it hampered what he could accomplish. So I think we get out of this that when Jesus has shown compassion on us, we need to respond to his compassion in the appropriate way, and that obedience, even in little things that we can't figure out why he has said that, obedience to those things still matters. And so if I'm having a discussion with one of you, or you're having a discussion with me about how to follow God's will in our personal lives or in the work that we're trying to do as a spiritual community, we need to be careful about how we reason, how we think through what God wants and what he cares about and what he doesn't. Because sometimes you might look at something and say, well, surely that's not actually that big of a deal. And I can see some use and some value and some good things that can happen if we do X, Y, and Z together or myself. If we're just thinking that way, we're on shaky ground. Because there's a way that seems right to a man, Proverbs says. But maybe that thing that we want to do actually hampers the work that God is doing in ways that we just don't understand. And it could be just a timing issue, because is there going to come a time where he wants everybody to go out to everybody and spread the news? Yes, and that's coming later in this book, but not now, later. So we've got to respect his timing and respect whatever it is that he's told us about. So then we've got, as I just mentioned before, we've got a story about a mute guy in 32 and 34. And this is an interesting story, because you notice in verse 32, the reason why he is mute is not because of some sort of defect, birth defect in his body. No, the only thing that seems to be wrong with him is he has a demon living inside of him that is causing him to not say anything. And so physically, his body is affected. But I think we can look at this picture and see that spiritually speaking, this is also what happens when the devil gets into our hearts and starts ripping down walls and pouring acid on the concrete and just doing all kinds of terrible things to our body, our souls. So this is what happens to a person who Satan has corrupted. Proverbs 24:7, wisdom is too high for a fool. In the gate, he does not open his mouth. Isn't that interesting? So in other words, somebody who has foolishness living inside of him, he doesn't have anything to contribute when wise words are needed. So he doesn't say anything. He is mute. And when a fool does open his mouth, you know, what's going to come out? Well, complaining, harsh words, gossiping, tearing down instead of building up. But what was the human voice created for? Why do we have the ability to speak, to sing? We didn't have to have that ability. We have that in us so that we can, in lots of different ways, in lots of different contexts, celebrate the one who's made us and saved us. And to help other people to use their voices that way as well. And that's what happens here. Did you notice that? After he's healed, and after he starts speaking, what then happens around him to the other people who are watching this happen? Did you see that? So verse 33, when the demon had been cast out, the mute man spoke, and the crowds then started speaking. The crowds marveled, saying, never was anything like this seen in Israel. But the Pharisees said, he casts out demons by the prince of demons. So we have two interesting ideas here. We have the miracle, and then we have the after effects of it. And so we can see that Satan's going to deaden our voice, but Jesus can open our mouths so that praise and joy and instruction can flow from us and into other people so that they can open their mouths and do the same thing. But then we see the Pharisees' reaction, and we can see that because they were antithetical to the good news, because they didn't want the gospel, then what they're doing is they're misinterpreting, misunderstanding, and not appreciating the work that Jesus is doing because of the blindness that they've got in their hearts. This is so tragic because as they dissect and debate and try to cast Jesus down, you know, good things are happening right in front of their noses. You know, people's lives are being changed in huge, undeniable ways. And yet, they're too stubborn to see it, to praise God for it, to join in the effort to call in the sinners, as we talked about last week. And so this is instructive for me and for you, because if I ever find myself standing on the outskirts of an effort of good people trying to imperfectly do good things in this family or outside of it, and I just want to throw rocks at that, then that probably means that I need to do a heart check to make sure that I don't have the attitude of a Pharisee. Because when we do become like that, verse 34, we end up saying really, really foolish things. If our hearts are frustrated and angry, we'll end up criticizing what we should be taking joy in. And then in 35 through 38, we've got this section about Jesus with people, and this is where the title of the sermon comes from. The central idea of this whole text is here, where he's with the crowds, and he's talking about what is going on in their lives. I want you to notice how 9:35 is just about identical to a verse that we've already seen before in Matthew. So when you go back to 4:23, so right before his ministry really starts going, and we got the Sermon on the Mount in 5-7, and then we've got the miracles and the teachings after that. It's interesting that we've got this idea that kind of frames everything, that Jesus went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every disease and every affliction. And so I think that what's going on here in the structure of the book is that everything that's between these verses, which say he went around healing people's bodies and teaching their souls, that the in-between passages are a lot of teaching and a lot of stories about healing. You got the teaching in 5-7, you got the miracles and his work on people's bodies in the rest of this. And so I think it's really neat that he does that as he circulates. We talked a little bit about this on the Wednesday night that I was teaching about Samuel. Samuel had a circuit amongst the people as a judge. We see Jesus kind of doing that same thing here. He's getting out among the people. He's not sitting at his house in Capernaum. He is going throughout all of this whole region trying to do what he does to help people. And he's doing that knowing full well that as he encounters all these people out there, he's going to run into a lot of people with big, big problems. But going back to 9:13, he tells the Pharisees, that's the whole reason why I'm here. I'm not here so that I can sit in a palace and have servants fan me and give me grapes. You know, I'm here because I'm a doctor. And so I'm going to go find the sick people and I'm going to help them. You know, for you and me, there is a safety to be found in aloofness, in kind of hanging back, keeping ourselves distant and not involved, because then we can hang on to our energy, our physical energy, our emotional energy. But if we do that, we're not going to be following Jesus, because that's not what he's doing. He's going out. So we need to draw closer to that neighbor that we live next to, who we know is having big relationship problems with his spouse. We need to draw closer to that person inside of this group here, who we know, if we draw closer to that person, he's going to need or she's going to need a higher level of emotional support and spiritual teaching and time. Maybe lots of time. But if you do that, you just see and watch how the Lord will bless you for doing the same kind of work that he's doing. As he is with all these people, great hordes of unwashed masses, you know, what he tells his people is there's never a lack of harvest. That's never the problem, either the problem then or the problem now. There's never a lack of people who understand that they're hungry, but there is often a lack of people to help bring in the sheaves. And so what do we do about that? Since the Lord has control over the harvest, he's called the Lord of the harvest here in this passage, then what that means from us is that urgent prayer is needed. So first of all, so look at verse 36. I love the way 36 is worded here. What do you see when you see a crowd? When I'm out and about and I see a crowd, I often see an annoyance, something that I need to retreat from, especially if it's a crowd on the road or a crowd in a place where I'm trying to get through. When Jesus sees a crowd, though, he sees souls that are desperately searching for help. Notice the text describes them as, at least in the ESV, harassed and helpless. So they're getting beat down on and they're helpless, so they can't defend themselves. They got nothing to do about that. Sheep don't have huge fangs that they can rip into prey. There are a lot of things that they don't have. Sheep need the shepherd. And this is very much like what I think we read about in Ezekiel 34. Remember in that passage, God says about his sheep, the Israelites there, they were scattered because there was no shepherd, and they became food for all the wild beasts. My sheep were scattered. They wandered over all the mountains on every high hill. My sheep were scattered over all the face of the earth with none to search or seek for them. That was true in those days, and that's true again today. We need a shepherd. We need Jesus to be that shepherd for us. And so part of the way that he shepherds, though, is he looks at his guys and he says, I want you to do something. I want you to urgently go to God and ask that we have more people to come alongside of us and do this work. Because people are hungry. And we need to be praying the same thing today in our personal lives and in this church family, that we have more and more workers to do the harvest. I think it's interesting when you look at news articles about Bible sales that have been happening in the last several years. I read that in 2024, Bible sales in this country were at a 20-year high. And after 2024, that has just increased with really big spikes in after events like the assassination of Mr. Kirk. And so people are buying lots and lots of copies of Scripture. I'm assuming that they're reading them, or at least trying to, but they need help understanding them. And so as the world gets crazier and crazier and crazier, there seem to be more and more and more people who are trying blindly to look for answers. We got to pray that God puts them in our way. Because if you pray this prayer that, Lord, please send out more workers into the harvest, there's a good chance he's going to answer your prayer by saying, great, that means you. We got to be ready for that. Notice what we then have in 1 through 4 of chapter 10. He's just said, we need a lot of laborers. We got compassion on all these people. We need to bring them in. And then in the very next passage, we have the first workers, the first laborers that he sends out. And notice what he does. He wants them to do the same things that he's been doing in his work with other people, and to exercise the same kind of authority. They're not going to have the same level of authority, certainly. He's always going to be the king. They're always going to be the messengers of the king. But they are nevertheless given something here. In chapter 10, verse 1, he called to him his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every disease and every affliction, which he just said back there in 9:35, that's what he was doing, healing every disease, every affliction. Do you think about often in your life that as a disciple of Jesus, you have powerful authority to do this? Not to perform a whole bunch of miracles like this, but you have authority from the king to take his message to fellow Christians and to people on the outside. I'm reminded of Titus chapter 2 and verse 15 when I think about this. Paul was speaking to a hardworking Bible teacher, although Titus, interestingly enough, is never called an evangelist. He's never called somebody with a name tag. He's called my child in the faith,
But he knows his scripture, and he wants to help the people on Crete, so he's there at Paul's direction. And Paul told Titus, declare these things. Some of the things that Melvin read for us in Titus 2 about the grace of God. Declare these things. Exhort and rebuke with all authority. Let no one disregard you. Have we absorbed that into our souls? You know, what our culture really likes to preach is, you got to mind your own business. You got to let people just figure it out. You got to not tell other people how to live or what to do, definitely not how to think, because infringing on my rights to think and live as I believe that I should, that is the cardinal sin for Americans. And so I think in our American churches, we feel the pull of that mindset. And so when we look around us here and we see someone who clearly needs more teaching, clearly needs somebody to come alongside of them and help, sometimes we don't want to do that because we think, well, I don't want to overstep my bounds. And I understand that. I understand that. But nevertheless, have we forgotten that we have authority from the King to go and help and teach and heal? And on the other side of that, if we're the ones being approached, sometimes it's easy to get really defensive and antagonistic and draw knives when somebody is trying to say things to us that need to be said, because we have forgotten that other people have that authority with us from the King. And so if you're trying to walk with the Lord, if you're trying to give your heart and your mind over to understanding His thoughts and ways, then you have authority to gently insist that other people around you, whether they're in the church or not, follow the ways of this King. We need to wield that authority carefully with wisdom and discretion, but we do need to wield it. And lest anybody think, is he talking about me? All of these things that I give out as applications are first directed to me. And I figured that if I need to hear it, then some of you need to hear it too. So I'm saying it. Something else that I think we need to see here in 1 through 4, and this is just so neat to me, every time I read a list of the apostles' names, that Jesus chooses to call a very wide spectrum of different kinds of people to work together on the same team. By the way, the word apostle is actually a pretty rare word in Matthew and in the Gospels, but we see it happening here. They're not just disciples, they are apostles, they are messengers, they are people who are going to be sent out. I think that it's really important to think about the fact that all of these guys are handpicked intentionally by Jesus, and he knew exactly what he was doing here. Because sometimes when you sign up for a new job and you get into it, sometimes that job turns out to be different than what you were expecting when you went into it. And sometimes, on the flip side, your employer says about you, man, he is different than what I thought he was going to be like. So that kind of works both ways sometimes. And for the apostles, in signing up for this mission, you know, they knew that Jesus is the one, but they had no idea what they were getting into. But for Jesus, he knew exactly who he was hiring on to go spread his mission. He knew these guys inside and out. And sometimes he got frustrated with them. Sometimes he had conversations like, are you guys still not getting this? You know, don't be thinking about the fact that you didn't bring lunch. Think about me. Think about the mission. But he never turned to them and said, I regret making you an apostle, making you an apostle. It's not like he pointed to 12 guys randomly, and then he woke up the next day and he went, oh my word, what kind of doofuses did I pick? I mean, why did I pick doubting Thomas? Why did I pick a tax collector and a zealot to be on the same team? Those guys are going to be like oil and water the entire ministry and into the next phase. Why did I choose those hotheads, James and John, those sons of thunder? Why did I choose Judas, who's mentioned always, Peter's always mentioned at the first in every list of the apostles. Judas is always mentioned last. And you notice in the text that long before we actually get to the crucifixion and the trial and the betrayal, we're flat out told here that Judas is going to betray him there in 10:4. Why did I pick Judas? No, there were no mistakes. No mistakes. This was the exact combination of people that he wanted. Are there mistakes here? Are there? Has Jesus intentionally put us together in the combination in which we find ourselves in, with all of our strengths and weaknesses for purposes that only He knows? I'll leave you to ponder that, and I'll move on to the last point here. I said that this was a lesson about compassion, Jesus' compassion for people around him. All of these stories, whether it's the stories of him healing, the story of him with the crowd having this conversation with his disciples, or in 10:1-4, the record of the people that he has chosen to then send out, I think all of these things revolve around this idea that when Jesus has compassion, pity that fills his heart, this is what he does. He identifies needs concretely, not vaguely, not, well, I think they need some things. No, he knows what they need, and then he calls other people to come with him to the work. So is that what you're doing? Is that what I'm doing? Are we seeing needs? Or are we just kind of locked into our own system, our own rhythm, our own household, our own pace, our own families, so that we don't really see what's going on with other people? And then once we do see, are we walking with a slow enough pace to help? Are we pulling in other workers to do the work that needs to be done? Fathers and mothers, this is the goal of what we're trying to do in our parenting work with our children. We're trying to turn our kids into extensions of the work for Jesus that we are already doing. The Psalms describe children as arrows to be aimed and fired, sent out from your quiver and your bow. And if you're a mature Christian, whether you have children or not, that is your mission as well, is to gather people around you and then send them into areas where they are needed. We have two men in our congregation so far. I hope there will be more in future days. But we have two men who have the name tag of shepherd. There's so much more shepherding that needs to be done amongst us than two guys can do. There's so much work. Please help. Please have compassion. Please see what you can do And please draw in other people to help you do it. Let's get busy this week in doing good for the Lord and for each other. If we can help you with your spiritual life this morning, we would love to know how we can. So I encourage you to think about how Jesus affects your soul and to let us know, either in a public way or a private way after our assembly this morning, if we can be of use to you. Please communicate that. But an opportunity is now to do that as together we stand and sing.